This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is out on medical leave. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we visit with horticulturist Ron Smith about, well, the growing season, if you can even call it that, in the midst of this drought. But joining me now is Prairie Rose Seminole. We are going to talk about Native American access to voting. She recently was in a meeting with Vice President Kamala Harris and Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland. Prairie Rose, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
You have held a number of titles over the year. You're the former cultural advisor to the Sanford Health One Care Initiative. You were the American Indian Alaska Native Program Director for the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. You are the co-founder of the North Dakota Native American Caucus. You're currently working with a number of nonpartisan groups trying to increase voting, Emily's List, Vote Run Lead, Sally's List. It's no surprise to me that you were called into this meeting. Was it a surprise to you?
Actually, it was. It wasn't, right? Like, this was just your preparation and the issues that we care about and that we have been working on for such a long time, meeting people in the right spaces to have that influence. And then all of a sudden you get a phone call saying, hey, that influence has reached the office of the vice president and we'd like to extend an invitation. So that, I mean, it was surprising, but at the same time, it was just like, oh my gosh, all this hard work, it's actually going somewhere. Like, somebody's listening and paying attention.
Right. All this hard work. We're talking decades.
Decades. Yep. Especially in North Dakota. I mean, I've got involved with state politics here in 2008. You know, I was just a kind of a budding organizer and trying to find my way in this political landscape.
Hmm. How do you describe the tone of the meeting?
For the first time in a long time talking to an elected leader and at this level, and I mean, this was my first time talking to someone at this level, but oftentimes we have to educate elected leaders about this kind of like historical situation that has led up to the current dynamics and current realities of our the intentional efforts to suppress our votes, right? And a lot of that is this historical intention to not include us in the democratic process in this country. We didn't have the right to vote right away in 1924 when we became citizens. And in North Dakota, we would actually have to give up our tribal citizenship to vote, right? And that then meant that if enough of us gave up our tribal citizenship, then there wouldn't be a treaty agreement between the U.S. government and the tribes. And it can get incredibly complicated. But for my point is, for this meeting, the tone was like, oh my gosh, we're sitting with people who get it.
Right.
They understand that. And we didn't have to spend a half hour of the meeting doing Indian 101.
Right. Well, because here we have the Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, Pueblo Laguna, just the highest ranking indigenous woman. I mean, let's be real here. She's eighth in line to the presidency, just under the attorney general. First of all, I guess just after these hundreds of years of systematic oppression and fighting and trying to make people understand, and you finally get somebody up into a cabinet level position, how does that feel?
It feels pretty amazing. And for us, it's not just about the first, right? We want to be celebrating the third and the 10th and the 20th that are coming up, right? We're just wanting to get into these systems that are making decisions about us. And there's no justice when we're not at those tables of justice, right? Mm-hmm. If nobody's taking on our cause, I think of farmers that I'm around right now who in the 80s were dealing with a very similar crisis in what we're dealing with today. And leaders went to Congress and fought for them, right? Like, that's happening now. We're seeing this huge fight coming forward just for for relief. And that's coming after the pandemic, that's coming after this drought. And when we're talking about voting rights in this country, there's so many changes being made at the state level. We need that federal level to ensure our right to vote and to uphold that access, because states are making changes that maybe seem neutral, like the voter ID law. That makes sense, right? But you're not realizing as an average citizen how that disenfranchises an entire population who may not have access to, you know, the 911 address system in North Dakota to have a physical address listed on your ID, right? The 50 miles I have to drive to get a state issued ID. There were so many barriers in place that were implemented at the last minute that they knowingly passed these laws, that knowing that tribes and rural voters and senior citizens and college students meet those requirements, right? So, and there's more like that they're just kind of ridiculous, you know, to make it less of a right, but more of a privilege to vote. And that shouldn't be the way it should be.
Right. When they're passing things like the Voter ID Act, were there any efforts that went along with it? Like, okay, we understand this is harder. You don't have the same address system that right. we do, but we are going to help implement that. Did we see any of that going along?
Nope. It was like an unfunded mandate happening at the state level, and it's happening across the country. I mean, the unique thing that occurred with those of us who were able to visit with Vice President Kamala Harris and Secretary Holland was that we came from states where similar pieces of legislation were coming forward. And for us in North Dakota, the Supreme Court sided with the tribes, right? So we just saw headlines a week or two ago where the state now has to pay legal fees back to the tribes who were part of that lawsuit. But in Arizona, the Supreme Court voted for the side of the state, right? So now the tribes are having to see these barriers legislated into law, right? That is limiting ballot access and ballot collection mm-hmm. by organizers. So there's some really unique situations happening across the state because similar laws were moving forward. Some were passed, some weren't, some are going into the court systems, and the courts are siding differently. And so we'll probably see these cases go up to the Supreme Court, and that's where we need the federal laws moving forward to really attach the Native American voting rights law to it, because that will only strengthen any movement going forward to strengthen our right to vote, but ensure that tribes have that same access given the barriers that we have in place.
You said it was so nice to come into this room to talk to people who get it. You don't have to explain oppression to women who have overcome oppression on multiple levels. So did it feel like, okay, I didn't just waste, you know, 90 minutes trying to explain where I'm coming from, and you could get right down to business? What is that business? I mean, it's watching the laws, but then there has to be, you know, an action plan.
Absolutely. You know, the friends who know me and people who've worked with me know that I'm an organizer first, right? Like, we have to have a message. Like, what is our ask when we go into these meetings? And I'm usually pretty laid back about it when I'm approaching these conversations, because we're often dealing with folks that we know it might not go anywhere, right? But this is the vice president, right? We just found out that Deb Haaland was meeting with us that morning, so none of us were totally prepared to have the Secretary of Interior with us in that meeting. But I had called President Killer from the Oglala Sioux tribe and Allie Young with Protect the Sacred. Those are two individuals that I knew were going to be a part of this meeting. And then we invited Chairwoman Shelley Fiant from the Salish Kootenai tribe up in Montana, as well as Julie Kitka from the Alaska Native Federation. Those were the five of us who were invited to this particular gathering. And Julie couldn't join us, but the rest of us were able to organize our asks and to really get down to a few minutes of telling our story and making sure that we had in there. And to our surprise, so we didn't have to do the Indian 101. We all got to share our stories. We all got to receive, question and dialogue with the vice president and Secretary Holland. And then we had some time, right? So there was this time to have a really incredible dialogue, deepening that understanding on that unique space of where we are with the Native vote movement, as well as these justice moments that were that are happening across the country. Black Lives Matter, you know, there's so much out there. Between the Native vote movement and the justice moments, where we have to inform not just our elected leaders, but that they inform the meaningful policy that's moving forward. So especially with the Native vote, I mean, this is about the trust relationship between tribal nations and the governments around us. That's not just the state and federal level, but the county and local governments that we need to be in relationship with. So I feel like we accomplished a lot within that initial meeting, and we left feeling very hopeful, because that's the impression that the vice president gave us with her commitment to moving forward the voting legislations that's in Congress now. There's two. I should have notes in front of me, but the John Lewis voting rights and For the People, I believe, are the two that are moving forward. And they're just very committed, and they understand that unique circumstances that we are in with Native vote.
We're visiting with Prairie Rose Seminole. She is a member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation. Recently met with Vice President Kamala Harris and Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland to talk about access to voting among Indigenous people. Where do you go from here, Prairie Rose?
I wish it was an easy next step, right? it was interesting to find out at the national level, there's 18 states that are moving forward all this legislation that's creating barriers for voters across the country, not just Native voters, but low-income Black voters, Latino voters. Like, there's just so many... It's crazy to me. Like, why would we make this more restrictive? I don't understand it, right? Like, there's this idea, even in North Dakota, when the voter ID logs came out, we were asking the questions, like, we've had no voter fraud in this state. We have voter integrity. So why are we making this harder for people to vote? And that's the argument that these laws are moving forward with, this rubric of voter integrity, even though these states are carrying out elections where there was no evidence of voter fraud or lack of voter integrity. They're saying we want to preserve this, right? And we have to have our elected leaders held accountable to really challenge that thought of, well, why are we doing this, right? And it gets down to, you know, the nitty-gritty of those who've been left out of this system for so long starting to get involved. And once we get involved, things are changing, and things are changing in a way that I feel are much more democratic, not necessarily in a partisan way, but in an accessible way, right, to being involved in an engaged citizen. And then moving towards a governance structure that works for all of us. And that has to only happen when we're engaged, when we're accountable citizens, and holding our elected leaders accountable. So the next steps really are hopefully building that leadership structure up so that we have more Native folks and more folks from demographics that are not dominantly represented in our elected offices to run for office. Because our government structure should look more reflective, right? Like that that ideal of that reflective democracy, we want that in place. And right now in North Dakota and many other states, we don't have much of a reflective democracy. And I think we can work towards that.
Why is it so important to start those races at the local level?
There's value in those offices. For me, it's about visibility. Visibility really matters. We want our young people to see and be engaged with just the practice of voting. You know, I was somebody who got to follow. I mean, I got to walk to the polling location with my parents as in elementary school because the polling location was at my elementary school, right? So I got to witness this practice of voting and being involved. And so when I could get involved and vote, I was already in the practice of voting, right? But I wasn't in the practice of seeing people like me represented at a local or a state or even a federal level. But I saw people who reflected the values that I had within my household, and that visibility really matters to young people. When that sense of viability of, if I see it, I can be it. You know, we want our young people to believe that they can be the next Olympian or the next Bill Gates or the next, you know, innovative entrepreneur, or that next farmer bringing us local foods, right? Like we want to show that we value those practices and that role in our community and beyond visibility, right? Like I think of the issue of our graduates wearing eagle feathers and plumes at graduation when there used to be such a opposition to it. It's a success story for our young people to even make it through schools. I mean, you've probably heard of the survivors coming out from the residential and boarding school situations, and now we're seeing those who didn't make it out, right? We're finding grave sites and so much that we've lost. I mean, it's such a win for our young people to even make it through a high school assimilative environment, right? That challenge us to leave our identities at the door. And we shouldn't. We should be able to be our whole selves wherever we are, in education or in public life, and be proud of that and be proud of our diversity.
Talking about those schools and this, just any visible display of your cultural or religious beliefs, whether it's at graduation or at any, you know, sacred time, there has been a little bit more understanding of how violent that suppression really was. Speaking as a white person, very much whitewashed in school, grew up with this idea that there were a few, and this is not a word I'm very comfortable using, but there were just a few savages here, and they needed to be, you know, sort of taught how to be humans, et cetera.
Right.
And then just unlearning these things with books like The Stringing Rosaries by Denise Lajmadeer, talking about what it was like in the school system to be beaten, to be killed, to be tortured. Sometimes teachers made children beat other children for not behaving in class. And oftentimes these schools were religious schools. And so I'm very curious about your former role as the American Indian Alaska Native Program Director for the Evangelical Lutheran Church, a predominantly white denomination. You spent a few years in this role and you left about a year ago. Do you see an increased understanding of those atrocities?
I do. And this is a lot of work within a lot of denominations, actually. I was working very closely with the Presbyterians, the Episcopal Church, the Friends, the Quakers at a national level, within my role within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And I actually had started educating peers and being contracted by the ELCA well before I was in the role as program director, talking about the generations or the various eras of Indian history, right? So we start out with kind of this, you know, policies of genocide and assimilation into the boarding school era, and then to determination, self-determination and sovereignty and where we are today. And myself, I'm the first generation that didn't go to boarding school. My dad, who would be 84, if I can do math quickly in my head, who's no longer with us, along with his sister, they survived the boarding school treatments, and they don't talk very much of their experience And my sisters and I, we were sent to a residential school in North Dakota here. It used to be called the Wahpeton Indian School. Now it's a Circle of Nations school. And previous before that, it was the last school that was formed by an act of Congress to remove Native children in North Dakota and in the region to go to the agricultural school, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm a part of this history. I'm a part of this living history. And there was a lot within my own story that I could bring to the dominant culture within the church. And there was a lot of vulnerability there, right? Like, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that for every Indigenous person or person of color to become that vulnerable to be humanized so that your history is real to people. There was such a hunger for that story to be told once the church repudiated the Doctrine of Discovery in 2016, which was one of my first big accomplishments in the ELCA, was having 23 synods within 65 synods move that forward at their national assembly and to have it pass such overwhelmingly.
And this was this idea that it's, you know, written in the Bible that this there is a land here that Christians had the right to claim.
Right. Okay. Yep. The Doctrine of Discovery is really a group of memos from the Catholic Church, from papal bulls that say if the land is not Christian, you have a right to take it. That's where we start with kind of the white colonization of the world and establishing really a hierarchy of human value based on race and promoting white supremacy and specifically white Christian hetero male supremacy. I was in Estes Park, Colorado, and I had challenged the participants of that gathering, and there was going to be about 400 people there, to understand their history and where they came from and who was there at their home site under the Homestead Act prior to them claiming that right, right? And one individual came up, and it was their family had come from Nebraska and had understood the treaty that basically said that we will take the children of the Pawnee until all of them are assimilated in exchange for their land. And that made them incredibly sad, saying my family was a part of this egregious act, basically say, we're going to take your children away forever. Right. This is a law that started in the 1860s, right?
This is not ancient history.
Right. And didn't stop until 1978. So we've got just over 100 years of removing children from families. And you know, when those laws were passed, you think about there was kind of two dominant mindsets. At the same time that the boarding schools were initiated and became funded, right? That was an act of Congress that funded the boarding school era within the United States and gave basically federal contracts out to these denominations to see the schools through and taking on that responsibility to educate and assimilate our children. But it was still just after an era of genocide versus assimilation. But the other school of thought was law for such a long time mm-hmm. that we were in the Department of War, and we're now in the Department of Interior with our national park system, our flora and fauna within the United States, and we shouldn't be there. We should have our own established presence within our government structure versus being an issue to be dealt with, because we're full citizens. We have every right to be full citizens.
Prairie Rose Seminole, co-founder of the North Dakota Native American Caucus, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you so much.
There is an extended version of that conversation on our website, prairiepublic.org. Still to come on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith. But now, this news.
A law firm in Houston required everyone on staff to get vaccinated, doubling down on the belief that being in the office means better work. Will other employers follow suit? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson. Ground has been broken for the $1 billion Red River Valley Water Supply Project. The project will bring Missouri River water to the Red River in times of drought. a pipeline will carry water from the Missouri near Washburn to the Cheyenne River. More than 30 cities in central and eastern North Dakota will benefit from the project, the groundbreaking held today at Carrington, North Dakota.
When we first started looking into this project was a question of, is this dream ever going to come to reality? And we were very pleased as we went along. The legislative body began to be more and more helpful to us, and they wanted us to get water to the east just as much as we did.
That's Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney.
Our current drought conditions and the resulting water conservative measures that have been implemented throughout the state underline the importance and the need for the Red River Valley Water Supply Project.
North Dakota Lieutenant Governor Brent Sanford echoed those remarks.
All of the state's residents will benefit from the regional resiliency this project provides. This state bands together when there's extreme needs, projects, opportunities. We're all one.
North Dakota's Department of Human Services and the Health Department are working on merging the two agencies. The 2021 legislature passed a bill to make that merge happen. The deadline is September 2022. Since the session, the two agencies have been holding meetings described as town halls between the two staffs. The agencies are also looking at hiring consultants to help with the transition. The new agency will have an executive director as well as a state health officer. Current health officer Dr. Nazar Wiebe says so far things are going well.
We are working together on kind of like finding those synergies that will allow us to serve North Dakotans better and to provide more services as well as a better quality of services.
The health department has around 200 employees. The Department of Human Services has around 2,200 employees. A Cass County deputy has been arrested for DUI after crashing a vehicle with children inside. At around 6 p.m. Monday night, Fargo police responded to a crash that involved a Cass County deputy. The crash happened at Custom Express Car Wash in South Fargo. The driver of the vehicle identified as a Cass County deputy, Jacob Danielson. During the investigation, they found his two children were in the vehicle during the crash. No injuries were reported. Danielson was arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol with a minor present. Cass County Sheriff Jesse Johnner says an internal investigation within Cass County Sheriff's Office will take place, and Danielson will be placed on administrative leave. And the health department has confirmed one more death related to COVID-19 in North Dakota. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is horticulturist Ron Smith. He joins us periodically throughout the growing season to talk about different lawn and garden concerns. And Ron, this is a year you can almost not really call a growing season.
It's a stressful season for growing.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so because of the high temperatures that we've had and the lack of rain. We can try to ameliorate that somewhat by watering our lawn, watering our trees and shrubs and flowers and everything else. But now we're into a critical part of that water use, and we have to be very, very aware of how we use water. Yeah. Of course, we all need it. Our plants need it. But you have to stop and think. When they talk about an inch of rain coming down, they're talking about roughly 623 gallons per 1,000 square feet. So if you have a 10,000-square-foot lawn, just do the math. 10,000 times 623 gallons, and that's quite a bit of, you know, quite a bit of water.
Mm-hmm.
So you need that much on a lawn per week in order to keep it green. If you don't want to keep it green and spend that kind of money on your lawn, you can go ahead and let it go dormant, which a lot of people are doing.
A lot of cities are saying you have to.
Saying you have to do that, absolutely. But at the same time, going dormant can't go on forever. Mm. It could probably go ahead and get us through the month of August and maybe into early September without any rain, but then we need to get some water down there somehow if we don't get any rain. Because if we don't, the crown of the plant is going to be killed. And it's going to be the dead grass, not a dormant grass. It's like the difference between sleeping and being in the undertaker's office. Yeah, casket, I should say. So we need to give our lawns a little bit of water, roughly about a quarter of an inch every 2 weeks, every 10 days to 2 weeks, and that'll just keep the crown alive.
Okay.
And if you have an automatic irrigation system, most residential irrigation systems will deliver water about an inch per hour of running. They vary a little bit, but just roughly it's about an inch of water per hour of running full time. So if you take this and say half an hour is a half an inch and a quarter of an hour is a quarter of an inch.
Okay.
So if you can get it a quarter of an inch or a quarter of an hour each time you go ahead and water, it won't green it up, but it'll just keep the crown alive. And it'll come back when the weather cooperates a little bit better.
When you're looking at grass, and what would you be looking for to see the difference between a grass in dormancy and a grass that has really started to die?
It really does look pretty much the same. If it's dormant, it's going to have some tightness to it. It's going to have a little bit of resilience to it. If it's dead, it pulls out like almost like a toupee. In fact, I visited a lawn this morning where the homeowner had claimed that they had been watering their lawn, and in some places you try to put a probe in there, and it would take the three of us in the studio to jump up and down on that probe to go ahead and get it in the ground. In another place, a lightweight like you, poof, it goes in as easy as can be. So so his irrigation system isn't doing what he thinks it's doing.
Oh.
So he needs to get up in the morning, run it some time, and see just how effective his irrigation system is.
Okay. So, Director of Radio Bill Thomas has stopped in. He has a question about lawns or gardens.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Ron. I got a question about the drought and naked ladies.
The butterfly.
Fascinating.
No, they're also known as surprise lilies.
The what? I'm sorry.
Surprise lilies.
Okay, you got me.
So it's a lily, and it puts up foliage. You know, leaves. The typical long lily leaves come up early in the year, and then the leaves totally die down. And the ground just looks empty. And then normally, sometime usually in August, up comes a stalk with a big lily on the top of it, with no leaves, just the stalk all by itself. And my mom always called those naked ladies. But they're also known as surprise lilies because the foliage dies down. You think it's all gone. And then, surprise, here it comes. My question is about... And maybe this applies to bulbs in general, bulbs in drought. We have been thinking of these as deep enough that they're probably okay and they're down there. But I kind of wondered about bulbs like these. We haven't been specially watering them or anything. And do we need to be doing that with this drought going on?
Well, I would give them at least one good soaking between now and any kind of a sign of emergence coming up. You say it's roughly in September they start to show through?
Yeah, late August.
Late August, early September, yeah. Might be a little bit faster this year because of the high temperatures. The high temperatures accelerate everything that we think of as being normal. And sometimes they go so fast that they can't keep, nature can't keep up with it. So I'd give them, your naked ladies, a shot of water, a good soaking, and then see when it starts to emerge again in a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. Give it another shot, and then it should be okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're beautiful. You know, now that you mention it, and I've seen our
producer Skip Wood, Googled this.
Skip sent us a photo.
Please, if you're going to Google this at home, make sure you include the word lilies.
So I know what you're talking about. Just drew a blank on it.
And would that be the same for other bulb type things that they're pretty secure, but you need to give them some?
Well, if you're talking about other bulbs, you have crocus and tulips, for example, and daylilies. Not daylilies. Daylilies are literally almost indestructible if you figure out a way to kill daylilies.
Right.
By depriving them of water, write a book about it, because sometimes they just get away too much. But, your typical tulip bulbs, of course, flower in the spring, and then they keep their foliage there until it desiccates naturally. And when they do die off, that means that they have secured themselves in having enough food and hopefully water, moisture in their bulb to go ahead and come forth this next spring. Quite frankly, I've never paid any attention to them. Once I've gotten them in the ground, they're pretty much on their own.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought too. And then I was thinking, hey, wait a minute, this year's may be different.
Well, we've had tulips and daffodils in our garden, our planting beds, since we planted them in 1986, and they're still coming up every spring. So,
yeah.
And we've just Oh, yeah, well, there's tulips here. I forgot about them. And look at those daffodils. Aren't they neat? They're always a nice surprise for us. So.
Yeah. Okay, all right, thanks.
All right.
Thank
surprise
you, Bill.
Surprise naked ladies.
All yep, right. Naked ladies. All
the
right.
The things you learn on public radio. We are visiting today with horticulturist Ron Smith. And, Ron, I also have a question about watering and drought. As you know, I have been converting my lawn over to
wildflowers.
To wildflowers. And this is the third spring, and it's really the first year that we've gotten a substantial amount of blossoms.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because they spend the first 2 years, as I understand, at growing the roots so that they can become drought and flood tolerant. Mm-hmm. And boy, I'm right next to all grass, and there is a remarkable difference. Mm-hmm. I have lots of green, lots of blossoms. I've only watered once, but now they are looking a little wilty. Mm-hmm. For the sake of my prairie, what is the best approach to keeping an eye on and deciding when to water that?
Well, just like you after a long hike or a long run or whatever, they
an
would
ice
appreciate
cream sandwich?
A little bit of water.
Okay.
It's probably not going to kill them because they have, being wildflowers, they have a way of shutting themselves down as nature goes through her fluctuations. So I'd say you're pretty safe letting them be, but if you want to keep them looking good and keep the recovery rate at the optimal level, then go ahead and expend a little bit of water to them and they should be okay.
Okay.
So no problem.
How about for immature trees?
Young trees, of course, what we used to do in Texas and Arizona and certainly in Saudi Arabia was to dig a hole, pre-water the hole, water the hole before you put the tree in, and then put the tree in root ball or containerized roots and then water it again. And what you do then is the roots, when they start to move with a flow of water, they're going to be moving into moist soil, not hitting that barrier of bone dry soil, because roots will not penetrate dry soil. Mm. They'll go where there's a balance of water and air. So your trees, if you've planted them within the last 3 to 5 years, should probably get a good soaking. If it was within the last 2 years, I'd soak them every week, give them a good soaking. If it's getting into the 3 to 5 year range, then I give them a soaking maybe every 2 weeks to 3 weeks, depending on how they are growing. If they've rooted in, they're showing some vigor, then you can go ahead and water them every 2 to 3 weeks. Our mature trees, like I have a mature birch there that's been there for, you know, 3.5 decades. It's a big baby. It gets water incidentally from our irrigation of our lawn, but if you have mature trees like ashes and maples and oaks and whatever, elms, if you give them a good soaking, they will be all right. You only need to do that about once or twice during the summer. If we get a good soaking rain, say this coming weekend, then we're going to see them look nice and perky, but they're also going to probably have some leaf drop taking place, and it upsets people lots of times. I just watered my trees, gave them a good soaking, like you said, and bingo, you know, about a third of the leaves or a quarter of the leaves fell off and they're on the ground. Does that mean I killed it or was it already dead? No, it's just they had formed an abscission layer there earlier on because of the drought, trying to conserve their own moisture loss. And when that water from the root system came up, it just helped sever the abscission layer there, as the name implies, and they dropped off those leaves that they didn't want to have there, you know, consuming more moisture, I should say.
Okay. So it's like spring, and you start out by wearing a couple layers, and then as it gets nicer out,
you
take something off. Okay. Well, talking about trees and mature trees, and they are such an investment, and they add obviously, height and beauty and structure, but then they also can help keep your house cool. There's a lot of good reasons to have a mature tree on your yard.
Mm-hmm.
If you are starting to worry that your tree is getting a little too mature and you want to replace it with maybe even the exact tree, are you better to wait until the tree is gone and then replace it in the exact same spot? Can you grab a seed from that tree and start it 10 feet away or start it in the house a couple years? I'm asking for a me.
Okay. Well, basically what I have recommended, and I've used it myself, that tree is going to go. Okay. And depending on how important that tree was in conjunction to the aesthetics of your house, the value of your house, the shade it was casting, whatever, you can either wait until the thing is completely removed, which I have done on one of my trees, and then planted another tree there that I'm very, very happy with because it's growing at the rate that I want it to, and it's creating a nice little ornamental effect for me. In the other case, yes, I had a tree there that was providing some shade, a little bit too much, too big, so I'm going to have it removed, and I planted about 10 to 15 feet away another one there nearby, so that one can go ahead and get off to a good start and start pruning this other one back a little bit more to favor the growth of that new tree going in. And then when the time comes for it to come down, it's not going to be a total exposure of nakedness, like, wow, what happened to that tree?
Right. Change the microclimate, change the look, change the like feel of your whole yard.
Yeah. And I love looking back at our house when we first bought it. Not a stitch of landscaping around it. Now we have this huge cut-leaf weeping birch there that's just like, wow, what a difference. So they do add value to the property. They do add value to your home. So it's worth the investment. My feelings honestly are, be more concerned about your trees, your permanent landscape there, than you are about your turf. Yeah, the turf looks terrible.
Grass is easy to replace.
But you can change the turf literally overnight by ripping the old stuff out, cutting it out, and bringing in fresh new sod and putting it down, and bingo. It's like working in the field all day, coming home, taking a shower, and getting into your tuxedo. Wow, you would look different compared to what you were during the day, all sweaty and hot.
How about vegetables for this year?
Oh, yes, vegetables. Yes. Some are not doing very well. Some are doing very well. I'll talk about the ones that are doing very well. The summer straight neck and crook neck squashes are doing very well. They got started early. They had their flowers. They have male and female flowers. They had the right proportion. So they are producing their nice little squash, or they were up to this point. You get into others like peas and string beans.
Oh,
and
It's too hot for them.
It's too hot. Beetles, tomatoes, the blasting of the tomato blossoms and pepper blossoms. We have pepper plants there, and maybe we've got about three or four pepper fruits that are about the size, a little bit bigger than a fig, you know. And these are green, big bell, green bell peppers that you'd look forward to. So it's slowed things down. You get tomato. A blossom blot, and what tomatoes you do get, you oftentimes get blossom end rot, which is a very common affliction of people that grow tomatoes. So if you do have that, you don't want to keep continuing, oh, that's a beautiful tomato. You don't want to pick it off and, oh, that the blossom end is rotted, throw it away. That'll happen with the early ripening tomatoes. You don't want your subsequent ripening tomatoes to have that problem. So water them properly. Don't get too ambitious as far as cultivating around the tomato plants go with a hoe and things like that. The more root system they have, the more water they have, the more uniform growth you're going to get. And that tomato, or the blossom end rot on a tomato is due to a lack of calcium, not in the soil, but in being able to reach the plant as it's growing, that fruit as it's growing. So a little bit of more water will do wonders to move that calcium up to those terminal ends of the tomato plant, or the tomato fruit, I should say.
You sent me a photo of what looks like a bunch of spider webs
on the
yard. It's not Halloween. Why are you sending this?
No. The lawns, in spite of it being dry, you'd think we should be disease-free. They're just going to die from or go into dormancy.
Yeah.
But we've had very high dew points. And you get that dew forming on the lawn, and you don't have a lot of wind to kind of move the grass blades around and cool it off and dry it out a little bit. And that sits there overnight, well into the morning, and you see it the next day, and you think, wow, some spider's been pretty ambitious down there. It's not a spider. You can put your hand in it, and it'll just be this little mycelium that's forming as the initial stages of a fungal disease getting started. The nice thing about most home lawn disease problems is they, by and large, can outgrow it with subsequent good care. fertilization, watering, core aeration, power breaking, things like that. So it's not the end of the earth as far as your lawn goes, although some people think that it is. So basically, it's kind of an indication. You have the sniffles, you might come down with a bad cold. Mm-hmm. So take care of the sniffles, and you won't get any sicker. And it's the same thing with your lawn. You see that, okay, what can I do to correct that? Maybe mow a little bit higher. Don't mow as frequently. Don't be so generous with my watering that I'm keeping this too wet, too long, whatever. You know, try to adjust your cultural care so that it will recover from that. And then generally they do for the most part. So you don't need to use any type of fungicides to control it.
Does it tend to impact plants at all or just grass?
No, just strictly a turf grass disease.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about we're getting to the part of the year where some flowers have come and gone, mm-hmm. and we need to be starting to deadhead, right? And that's just popping the tops of the plants off after they're done blossoming?
Yeah, especially your perennials. And, of course, this is maybe like telling you this after they close the barn door after the cows have gotten out type thing. But one of the best ones I can think of is the May Night Salvia, which is a very, very beautiful purple-flowered salvia. Produces all these nice spike flowers on their plants. And as they start to finish blooming in June, you can go ahead and cut them back. If you have one of these electric hedge clippers, you can go ahead and just literally top it off, the flowers off, and it'll come back. And the pollinators will love you for that because this gives them more flowers to go ahead and go to. So as you see your flowers starting to fade, deadhead them so they aren't putting any energy into making seed, and they can continue to bloom, which will continue to give them, make them available
so
for
extending
your—
extending the blossom.
Extending the blossoming, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So.
One silver lining of the drought, or might be more accurate to say a red and yellow and orange mm-hmm. lining of the drought, is the fall colors.
Yes.
Are often better.
Yes.
When the season has been poor.
Well, I don't like to use the word poor. That's
okay.
Been a little bit more stressful.
Okay.
If we have a drying late summer going into fall, August, September, and they start talking about seasonal color, it'll be vivid. Beautifully vivid, fantastic, but it'll also be quick. If we have a rainy summer, late summer, going into early fall, it'll be kind of wimpish. Mm. You know.
They've been pampered?
You know. I'm sorry?
They've been pampered?
Yeah, they've been pampered, so they aren't going to try to shock you with their beauty or anything like that. No, but typically, of course, some plants are genetically predisposed to have good fall color, but their fall color will be better if they're put under a little bit more stress. Mm.
Have some already started to turn? Like you said earlier, the drought tends to accelerate
yes,
things.
Yes, you
like
start
this.
To see some of these showing up on some of the maples.
Okay.
Where they're a little bit more stressed. Generally, the ones that are planted in the curb areas where they don't get the attention that it would with a homeowner's, in the backyard.
Sure.
That type of thing. So you might see a little bit of fall color, and you might start noticing some of the leaves dropping on the ground from your tree or your neighbor's tree. Oh, they're starting to turn yellow. They're starting to turn a little bit orange already, and this is August. So,
We check in with horticulturist Ron Smith periodically during the growing season. Ron, thanks for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Good to see you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support is provided by North Dakota United, an organization of over 11,000 education and public employees serving the public every step of the way. Information available at ndunited.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 3rd. On this date in 1924, Ward County's Rice Lake Resort hosted the biggest celebration of Emancipation Day in North Dakota history. The Bismarck Tribune wrote, "A big Emancipation Day celebration is planned at which between 3,000 and 5,000 people are expected." A Berthold Tribune headline read, "Big Negro Emancipation Picnic will be held at Rice Lake, August 3rd. The Rider News and the Makoti Sentinel also reported on the upcoming celebration, saying it would be patterned very much after similar affairs that had been held in the South for years. From the 1840s to the 1910s, Afro-Americans in northern states celebrated August 1st or soon thereafter to celebrate the British Empire's peaceful emancipation of slaves in the 1830s. Although many of these celebrations were predictably segregated, some of the celebrations invited everyone. On August 7th, 1924, the Makoti Sentinel reported, "A large crowd of Makoti folks journeyed to Rice Lake last Sunday and enjoyed the day to the utmost. The roasted ox and 1,500 buns were disposed of in a hurry to the crowds, and the red-hot tamales were also served in abundance. The most interesting part of the day's entertainment was Carter, a Negro musician and entertainer who kept the crowd jolly throughout the day. Mr. Groniger of Dallax, a Civil War veteran, delivered a very interesting address on Civil War times and his experience in the service. Special accent was given in his brief mention of the hard times following the war, noting the present times to be much better. Immediately after his speech, the Bismarck and Karlsruhe baseball teams crossed their bats on the new diamond, and a very interesting game was witnessed by many spectators. At the end of the ninth inning, when the dust cleared away, Karlsruhe was found to be victorious." End of quote. No other celebration like this is known to have happened in North Dakota before or since. In 1924, the Nonpartisan League and the Ku Klux Klan were in a tug-of-war over the allegiance of gubernatorial candidate Arthur Sorley. This emancipation celebration came 1 week before Sorley's rally at Rice Lake, which may have tarnished his reputation among Klansmen. And perhaps the integrated celebration explains why the Klan bypassed Ward County. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
It's hard when you feel like you're an illegal person.
And he hit Matt along the head between 18 and 20 times.
So people always ask me if I feel like I'm challenging God's plan.
Watch Out in Rural America, stories of small-town Midwestern LGBTQ life, tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, having conversations about race and racism are not easy, but they are important. We're going to talk with Jason Spencer. Originally from Fargo, he has worked for National Geographic Television, Discovery, Animal Planet, and most recently picked up a Daytime Emmy for the show PBS Kids Talk About Race and Racism. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.